If you're a modem user and you live in the United States, now you can have quality, reliable internet access and support ACB radio at the same time. Easy Access USA gives you flat rate 56K internet access, two email accounts, and Usenet news groups for only $19.95 a month. And every month, $4 of that great price goes to ACB Radio, so we can keep bringing you your favorite shows and expanding our service. So don't delay. Switch today to Easy Access USA. Surf on over now to www.easyaccessusa.net. That's www.easyaccessusa.net. Or if you'd rather sign up over the phone, call them toll-free at 866-835-7872. That's 866-835-7872 between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern. Easy Access USA and ACB Radio, working together to bring you the best. As well as ACB Radio Mainstream,
The Cafe,
ACB Radio Treasure Trove, you can hear
live, unpredictable internet
on the ACB Radio Interactive. ACB Radio Interactive. Playing music from
the 1930s and 40s.
The 50s and 60s.
The 1970s.
80s and 90s.
The hits of the new millennium.
ACB Radio Interactive comes to you from at least six time zones on three continents, bringing you the very best of
country,
top 40,
classic and modern rock,
new age,
folk,
the rare stuff out of the 50s,
jazz,
easy listening adult contemporary,
and more. Live, unpredictable internet radio.
ACB Radio Interactive.
For the latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organizations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.
If you'd like to keep up to date with what's happening on ACB Radio, then join ACB Radio Announce. It's an announcements-only email list that keeps you up to date with programming, scheduled outages, and other interesting pieces about the ACB Radio website. To join, send a message to majordomo at telepath.com and put subscribe ACB Radio-announce in the body of the message. That's majordomo at telepath.com with subscribe ACB Radio-announce in the body of your message. Keep in touch with ACB Radio, the station that's out of sight.
ACB Radio.org.
Back to the ACB 40th Annual Convention in Des Moines, Iowa, from the Polk County Convention Complex. This is Jonathan Mosen. It's Thursday afternoon, the 5th of July, and we're about to stream some proceedings of a seminar from the American Council of the Blind Government Employees, looking at a couple of important issues. The unemployment rate among Americans who are blind or visually impaired at around about 70%. With all the technological innovation that's out there, what's the cause of that? Why is there such a high percentage of unemployed people in our community? So we'll discuss that, and latterly we'll take a look at the Rehabilitation Act, Section 508. That has really come into full force now, and there'll be some panelists who will guide us through that, and also talk about the reauthorization of the Rehab Act. So that's sort of come in the next little while here on ACB Radio Mainstream. I'm conscious that there appear to be a couple of issues with our streaming media provider, and so we will cross our fingers and hope that our good luck doesn't run out. But everything is streaming just fine from this end. So if there are problems, it's in San Francisco somewhere, some distance away from us here in Des Moines, Iowa. We're expecting a start fairly soon, and let me remind you while we await the start of proceedings that we will be covering for you tomorrow the election of officers at the American Council of the Blind. There will be some other business as well, including the international speaker this year, who will tell us about the situation with consumerism in Canada, which is developing very nicely. And we'll also, though, the main item of business will be the elections. And we hope to have ACB President Paul Edwards join us at around about 8:15, about a quarter of an hour before proceedings begin, to give us a bit of information about the way things are going to work tomorrow, how the election system in the American Council of the Blind works, so that as you listen and the tension builds, you will be able to follow proceedings and fully understand what's taking place. So hopefully Paul Edwards will find time in the schedule. He's certainly attempting to make time in the schedule to join us at 8:15 tomorrow. On Friday evening, that's tomorrow evening, the banquet will take place. And the banquet entertainment is coming from ACB Radio this year. And the banquet entertainment tomorrow night is going to take an interesting form, and there'll also be a special announcement from ACB Radio Interactive that I know you'll look forward to hearing about. So that's all coming up tomorrow night. There are other banquet proceedings, and we will broadcast those. What we will not broadcast, though, is the munching. You'll be pleased to hear that, I'm sure. And so we will join you after the food. And I expect that will be around about 8 o'clock Central Time, 1 o'clock GMT on Saturday morning. That's right, 1 o'clock GMT Saturday morning. So we're talking probably, but it could be a bit earlier, it could be a bit later, but probably about 9 Eastern, 8 Central, 6 Pacific, tomorrow night, Friday evening, for the banquet coverage. And then we wrap up our coverage of the ACB's 40th annual convention by bringing you convention proceedings on Saturday. And Paul Edwards will make some final reflections as he leaves the role of President of the American Council of the Blind. Constitutional provisions mean that presidents of ACB and other officers, in fact, can only serve 3 consecutive terms in a position. And so Paul will give some reflections, but predominantly on Saturday there will be resolutions. The resolutions committee process means that people can... yes, we are on. I think it's Mitch, just making sure the sound's working. The resolutions committee process means that all resolutions are submitted to the committee, and they may be tweaked in such a way that it improves grammatical issues, lessons, ambiguities, etc. But all resolutions do go to the floor, and the resolutions committee moves either a do pass or do not pass. And so the resolutions are very much a grassroots thing, and you'll be able to hear all of those. Well, some tomorrow. I imagine that as the standing votes are being taken for the officers, we'll proceed with some resolutions and other matters, but predominantly I think Saturday will be the day that the resolutions are debated. And that's always interesting because the debate is often lively, particularly on some of the more contentious matters, and you can hear it all here on ACB Radio Mainstream, bringing you convention coverage from Des Moines, Iowa. We are looking ahead to next year, and I have had some email from people asking about details for registering for Convention 2002, which is taking place in Houston, Texas, and I am endeavouring to get that information and make it available to you, because you've got to register quick in order to get the primary hotel. So we're trying to make sure that you have the information you need in order to do that. So that's pre-registration information for Convention 2002 sometime soon. We're doing our best to track that down for you. And thanks to those of you who've emailed asking for further details about that. We're about to make a start on this presentation, looking first, I believe, at issues of unemployment in the blind community. And after that, we look at Section 508 of the Rehab Act. And a reminder that I'm not actually sure if I have access to a working microphone here, so we may not be able to take questions and pass them on to the floor. However, if you have any comments that you want to pass on to us to discuss in breaks like this, where we're just talking to you and waiting for proceedings to happen, then by all means send them in. We'll do our best to find some answers for you if there are questions. It's convention@acbradio.org is the email address. convention@acbradio.org. We will not, just confirming, be streaming the candidates forum tonight. We would like to have been able to do that, but for logistical reasons, namely that we're based here, we can't do that.
That's a good mic. Having been a trainer for 10 years, I value starting on time, and I appreciate folks who are here on time, and therefore, we're going to start on time. I'm Mitch Pomerantz, president of ACB, Government Employees, and I want to welcome you to our Employment Roundtable, which is the first of our two program items. I also want to say that I am very honored, and Peter will talk a little bit about how this program came together, but I am honored that the folks in ACB felt that this topic and the second program item this afternoon that deals with Section 508 felt that these two issues were of significant value and sufficient value to move us from where we were originally scheduled and brought us over here, because we are being streamed live on ACB Radio. So I want to say hi to all the folks who are listening to us on that medium. And we're going to have a frank, open discussion for the next hour and a half on employment. And then we are going to have a discussion at about 3:45, beginning at about 3:45, on Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which deals with access to technology. I'm going to turn the program over for the next hour and a half, to a friend and colleague of many years who is going to facilitate this panel presentation. He will introduce the panel members. I'm actually going to be one of them, because I didn't start this. Bill Lewis started this, and then I weighed in, and it went from there. But Peter will explain all of that to you. But I want to introduce my friend and colleague, Peter Altschul.
Thank you, Mitch, and welcome to all of you. I'm delighted that you're all here, and I do want to say a few words about how this program got started. I'm sure all of us are readers of the Borough Forum. Is that correct? Do we actually read the Borough Forum? That's good. Very nice. Some of you may remember an article, a series of letters to the editors that came out of an article that Bill Lewis wrote about this issue of employment. And Bill did a sort of a summary of the history and wrote a summary of the kinds of things that blind folks were doing. And that prompted a rather acerbic letter from a woman named Lucia Moret, who essentially said, this is all pie-in-the-sky nonsense. I'm paraphrasing, but that was the essential version of her letter, among other things. And then Mitch said, you know, essentially, what are you doing? Thank you. Okay, thanks. That Bill had a bunch of points, and that a lot of this had to do with personal responsibility, whereas Lucia had said this has to do with societal responsibility. And I sort of, as one who's been concerned that this is an issue that the ACB hasn't talked about a lot, I took it upon myself to write a response essentially saying there's a lot of truth in both views, and also saying I'd be delighted to have a conversation about this if the opportunity arose. And Mitch called and said, okay, do it. And so here I am. So that's the short version of how this process got started. And now I'm going to introduce the panelists. Then we're going to do a few things here. To my immediate left, is that right, Naomi? Is Naomi Soule, who initially worked for IBM in human resources and then in event planning, and now is working in the St. Louis Voc Rehab System as a supervisor in the Rehabilitation Services for the Blind in Missouri. Welcome. Bill Lewis, who is a retired clinical social worker in Wichita, Kansas. We welcome you, Bill. I've worked with Bill a little bit in prior incarnations of stuff. And the infamous, who you've already met, Mitch Pomerantz. Mitch has done a lot of human resources work for, and now is an ADA compliance officer for the city of Los Angeles. And so it's a diverse, if you will, panel who I'm sure will have some interesting things to say about all of this. Just to give you a sense of who I am currently the diversity specialist for Reuters. Reuters, for those who may not know, is a news service, sort of like AP, and well-regarded, particularly internationally, in London and other places. So, I really do want to make this as interactive as we possibly can, because this is a very complicated issue. There's a lot to be said about it, and we can't say everything we want to say about it, but I really would like to make this as interactive as possible. In order for this to work, I have a couple of requests. The first request is, please do not preach. When I'm trying to avoid is sort of the long-winded speeches, try to the extent possible, I would request, to be as concise as you can, given the complexity of this issue and the emotionality of this issue. I do request that. If we can do it, that would be great. Clearly, raising hands won't work. The other thing I would say is it would be helpful if we could, if you could speak your name before you, when it comes time to ask or respond or questions or whatever. This room has lousy acoustics. So I may have to sort of summarize into the microphone, particularly since this is on ACB radio. And again, I, like Mitch, welcome all of you who are listening. Before I turn it over to the panelists, I would ask people at random, no particular order, and it's, to please talk about what prompted you to come to this session. You know, this is lots of things happening at this time of the day. What prompted you to come to this session and or what would you like to see addressed during this session? So anybody who would like to respond to that, please do so now. No, for the audience. Audience.
Kathy Lyons, Buffalo, New York.
Yes, Kathy.
I retired from Internal Revenue Service in February after 27 years of service. For those of you who know civil service retirement system, that's 3 years early. So I was challenged to present a disability on everything except blindness. And I just didn't know till the letter came whether I would get it. But the last year that I was employed by the agency, I was chair of the disability committee. And it's kind of pathetic what non-disabled people know about disabilities. So I'm hoping to hear what other people might be doing. They replaced all the faucets in all the lavatories with spring-loaded faucets and no provision for handicapped people such as those with arthritis to be able to use the faucets. So,
okay, so Kathy, you're interested in talking about what kind of thing we can do to educate the non-blind folks about disability. Is that an accurate comment?
And also to try to not have them undoing progresses they've made in the past.
Okay.
With technology that may not be helpful.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Anybody else?
Yes, Mr. Pomerantz. This is Darian Hartman from Portland, Oregon. I work for IAM Cares, which is a national nonprofit job placement service that has partnership agreements with VR agencies to help clients get jobs. And I do a lot of the job readiness preparation work with clients who are job seekers. And I am really interested in letting people who are visually impaired know that it's very helpful to really be able to not only have the education, but be able to articulate your skills and be able to back up your articulation with actual ability to demonstrate your skills, and to have organizational skills and time management skills. These are the things that I see preventing some of my clients from becoming employed.
Okay, so the idea of articulating skills and being able to demonstrate the skills that you say you can do is what
right.
I heard from that.
Right, and the idea behind that is that we have to be our own best self-advocates.
Good. Anybody else?
Hi, this is Angie Wu. I am the intern at the National ACB office. And my big project is the reauthorization of the Rehab Act for 2002. So I'm here to hopefully gather some of you for the task force that we are creating. And also I want to see what some of the issues are and how maybe we can help legislative-wise to solve some of the employment issues.
So the sort of legislative piece of this puzzle?
Yes.
Okay. Others?
I had to put this much higher. This is Jonathan Ice. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes. Okay. I don't think I'm being amplified here. Anyway, in part of the blurb about this session, it was mentioned the 70% unemployment rate among blind people. For the 20 years or so that I've been looking at this kind of thing through the organized blind movement, the figure for unemployment for blind people has been at that point forever. And I know it remains high. But unemployment in the general workforce is a dynamic thing. It doesn't just stay at 3%, 4%, sometimes it gets up to 10%, etc. And have there been any fluctuations in the unemployment rate? It would be good to know. Have there been any effects from ADA? Have there been any effects of programming in certain states where you have lower unemployment rates among the blind than others? I haven't heard anything. I don't even know where these figures are coming from, and it seems to me that this may be just some kind of received wisdom that we're just passing around. Everyone knows it's 70%, and so everyone keeps on saying that, and we just assume that that's true, and we don't know. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Jonathan. So the whole 70%, what's up with that? Other requests. What do you want to talk about in this block of time?
Peter?
Yes.
This is Pam, and a couple of reasons why I came. Number one, I read the letters to the editor, and when I heard that this group of folks was going to get together, I couldn't hardly wait to hear this one. But the other point that I wanted to make is that it seems to me, I'm curious as to what these folks will share this afternoon about what we as an organization on the state, special interest, and national level should be doing to address this problem. We've been talking about it for years, and I think each of our panelists, I'm hoping they will share with us what it is we need to do to get at this.
Thank you, Pam. So what can we in the ACB, national, local, individual, help to do to help move this process forward a little bit? Or a lot?
Peter?
Yes.
This is Linda Oliva from Minneapolis. And we talked a little bit about this in one of the teachers' division groups the other day. The personality or personal responsibility piece intrigues me, because often in very small groups or in pairs or whatever, we will talk about things like, oh, everything from hygiene to clothes that never made it to the dry cleaner and 100 other little things that people either do not accept well when they are told about them in terms of a public presentation, or folks are just so frightened to broach a subject with someone that has to do with either terrible table manners or anything down the line from there. And this is so huge.
Yep.
And I mean, how do we even begin to crack something that either folks are in total denial about or refuse to accept once somebody has finally, you know, broken the ice? And how do you break the ice in some situations that the presentation is so tragic, it's hard to know where to begin.
So how do we deal with, we all know these people, right, who have, you know, issues, basic issues of hygiene or table manners or speaking, you know, whatever, rocking, you know, all those things we all know as blindisms. How can we as individuals help folks come to grips with them and do something about them? Any other last ones?
Yes, Peter.
Yes.
Roger Keeney from Athens, Georgia. One of the things that all these are very important issues, and the direction that I'd like to see more action done and see what we can do in this is an area that we hear a lot about in the school process now called transition. And, you know, it seems that our children with visual impairments in the classroom are still being handled in quote-unquote a special way that they're not getting the tools to be able to transition and go out there and compete. We all know that it's really hard to compete and really difficult to go get those jobs that and those places that will make the accommodations and so on. And these kids are growing up to believe that, oh, it's just going to be handed to me.
So the whole issue of how can we prepare...
How can we prepare these children to, with both the knowledge, the expertise, and the self-advocacy, to go out and not say, oh, will you please give it to me, but say, no, this is my right. And,
or this is what I'm good at, or
and,
this is
and yeah. I'm good at this job, and my and accommodation is my right.
We thank you, and I'm going to cut the. We have a lot to go on already, and I'm sure. What's that?
I'm the last one.
Okay,
no,
then do it. Thank you.
What about me?
That's okay. Thank you.
This is Billie Jean Keith from Virginia.
Hi, Billie Jean.
Hello, and I have a very strong feeling about children who are blind who are isolated sometimes in their schools. There may be only one blind child in a school, and the low expectations that are levied on these children, and sometimes their parents don't even understand that there are things they can do and don't see mentors or role models, so that these children grow up to expect that they're going to be working or expect that they're going to do something. I think it's the opposite of what the gentleman before me said, because I've seen this, especially in rural areas. I come from a state that has a lot of rural areas, and there are blind children who never know anyone who's blind, and they are just socially passed through school and never have expectations from
yep.
anyone in their family.
Thank you. So the idea of how can we handle this, these specific issues of sort of isolation and letting folks know if there are opportunities for them out there.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm gonna ask that there'll be more time for questions after this, but I do want to give the panelists that they've been very patient, but they have a lot to say. And so I would just like what I've heard basically are the following issues have come up, and I'm sure others will. Educating non-disabled folks about disabilities. Articulating skills and demonstrating them, how can we do that? General overview of legislative piece of the puzzle, how can we legislatively improve the picture a little bit? Why is the 70% rate stable, if it is, and where do these figures come from anyway? What we in ACB should be doing to address this issue? How to deal with all those issues like hygiene, et cetera? How can we alert folks to these issues in a way that they'll hear it, that they'll be heard? And the whole issue of transition from school to work, how to give youth the skills they need and how to help them deal with the isolation and low expectations that they often face. That's a lot of stuff to talk about. I'm going to ask the panelists to take about 5 minutes each. I can stop things. I have ways. I asked them to talk a little bit about what makes them interested in why they are interested in this topic, and to talk about any one of these pieces that they can address. And who would like to do the honors first? Okay, I'm giving the phone to Naomi.
Here's the microphone. Got it. Okay. Thanks for coming, everybody. This is a real. When I was asked to be on this panel, I had to think about, you know, trying not to get on my soapbox. But I work as a district supervisor for rehabilitation services for the blind in Missouri. And before I had that job, I was an employment specialist. And for the agency, and I covered half the state and worked with companies in hiring individuals, consumers of ours. And I saw a lot of things. It was real interesting for me to come into rehabilitation from private industry. I thought in my life that, you know, everybody was going to be like me, that I was self-motivated. I was very I was able to hold a competitive job with IBM. I worked there for 11 and a half years, and I did a lot of educating. Well, when I came to rehabilitation, I found that that wasn't necessarily the case. What I see a lot, and this is very important, and I can't stress it enough, even for people who are now working, which, you know, I think a lot of times people who are working tend to have sometimes fall back on some things. I would say that appearance is extremely important. And I'm going to tell you that I heard something today that was kind of disturbing. A friend of mine's uncle works for AT&T in New Jersey, and he said that they go to a lot of job fairs, a lot of events for people with disabilities, and that they hire a lot of individuals with disabilities who are in wheelchairs or who are hearing impaired or who have other disabilities. However, he said that they don't hire a lot of blind people because they do not give a good impression, that their appearance is horrible, and that it's not the image that they want in their company. Well, that says a lot to me. And I have been in situations where there are individuals who are working and who have very poor appearances. And I can't stress enough to everyone how important that is. And I know Pam asked a question about what can ACB do. I would like ACB to have a lot more emphasis on self-improvement at this convention. I think that's going to be important. It's also embarrassing to me as an ACB member to hear about appearances, about people's appearances at this convention, and how embarrassed a lot of people are by what they see here. And this is a mirror to me, and so that to me is the most important thing. Second thing is responsibility. I tell our consumers this is a 50-50 deal. We do our half, you do your half. No job is handed to anyone. And I really do believe that what Darian was saying about having good skills, having good organizational skills, having coming prepared for an interview, being able to get somewhere on time, these are things that I take for granted, but many people do not. And as a blind person, you have to be so much more organized and so much more prepared and so much more articulate. So I would say those are the main things.
Okay. Thank you, Artis.
Naomi.
Naomi.
Did I say Artis?
I know Artis.
I know. thank you, Naomi. You pass it on?
Sure. Okay, right in front of you. To Bill?
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
All right. Bill. All right. Did I respond to the same subject that Naomi was talking about?
Anyway, anything you want to do for the next 5 minutes.
Okay. I want to flip over to the next one.
Closer to the mic, Bill.
Okay. This is on the question of public perception. Since I seem to have gotten started on this a couple of years ago, I want to touch on it today. The problem of negative public perception and prejudice is something we will never overcome. The days are long gone when proclamations by the king could modify the ethics and morality of an entire nation or influence the subcultures of a nation. Even with the ADA and affirmative action, resistance regarding employment of us visually impaired still exists. Now, many people say the fault is at the foot of public perception. But why should public perception be more important for blind people than for anyone else? Because if we are blind or have very little usable vision, we look differently with our white cane, our guide dog, or our hand resting on somebody's arm. And anything different attracts attention. How many midgets or 7 feet tall people have you ever met? Chances are you'd remember almost all of them if you had, because they're differently from the ordinary composition of people in the environment. Now, on the other hand, we can be in a crowded room and people may act as if we are invisible and don't speak. Now, it's interesting that sighted people make initial contact usually with the eyes much more than with the voice. So to a sighted person, a blind person often looks like he or she is evading contact. Now, that's their perception. But once we have a place in the group and can tell people to speak up, the communication then becomes much more open. Now, I notice that many visually impaired students, also adults, join organizations and immediately assume leadership roles. Now, why? To demonstrate capability and establish one's place in the group, which provides a structured opportunity for informal and formal interpersonal contacts that can lead to situational friendships. This applies to church participation, too. It's an excellent way to become a part of an organization or a church. You can meet people and contribute something worthwhile at the same time. Now, as you know, we visually impaired people make sighted people doubt what we can do because they imagine themselves in our situation and they see themselves as not being able to handle much of anything effectively. Now, that's called a projected perception. However, if they know someone who has a visual problem and also is handling it well, usually their initial attitude to us, if they meet us for the first time, is usually friendly. So we can actually encounter a positive perception as well as a negative one. Now, the perception as a blind person in a volunteer organization, for example, is look how perceptions can shift. If you're the president of a person in a volunteer organization, you may be envied or admired for that. However, if you happen to be a supervisor in a business, or you're my boss in a business, the attitude towards you might be rather negative because of another perception, which is called we, you, us, and them. That arises from envy and from competition and an identification with the group, us against them, workers against the authority, the administration against the churlish workers. So, while we may be admired as the president of a volunteer organization, it's easy to be resented as a supervisor at work. But if the role of the supervisor helps the workers get their job done better and get more recognition, the resentment lessens because we become seen as working for them or working for their side. But if my role is to hand out demerits or criticize poor performance, then I become definitely on the other side. Now, see how quickly a stereotype perception can shift. Now, when we encounter stereotype perceptions, we've got three choices. One is to conform to whatever the other person says we should or should not do. Second, continue what we're doing because it's the right thing to do despite opposition. Or third, look for a different environment so we can do our thing in peace. Now, but why should prejudice and ignorance persist far after the facts are in? It's because every time there is a change of a wise executive director in a business and a change of political support politically, statewide or nationwide, we have to deal with new ignorant people all over again, over and over and over. So for the most part, each new crop of business leaders or personnel officers come to their jobs knowing very little about the abilities of blind workers. They do learn about Louis Braille in school, but not about all the blind people who are functioning very well and making high marks. Very few people know about legally blind architects or bankers or business owners or blind oceanographers or customer reps. Or probably some of you folks are in that category. They only know that there's an ADA and that there's an affirmative action law about which they have to be rather careful legally. because they read somewhere that disabled employees who are hired because of those laws are quick to sue in case they're unable to handle the job and have to be laid off. Although the vast majority of these lawsuits are settled in favor of the employer, such distractions cause worry and a waste of time and create considerable legal fees for the company. Now, this makes an employer wonder, why put myself and my company at risk for someone who might sue me if he or she cannot perform and has to be dismissed? So for one or two disabled workers versus hundreds of thousands of non-disabled workers in this company, why run the risk? And that's a big question.
Bill, I'm going to ask you to cut here. Thank you for your comments. And can we turn it over to Mitch, please?
Oh, wow. Let's see. No, Peter, they're sharing a mic over there. And there is a podium mic, which can be used too. Okay, let's see if I can answer a couple, three of these questions. Let me first deal with the one that Pam raised. I was originally going to raise it at the very end, but I think I'll just cut to the chase. That doesn't mean we can all go home. I'm going to propose to whomever the next ACB president is that ACB establish an employment issues committee. And that committee put forth one, at least, workshop per ACB convention and perhaps other material throughout the year. I think it's high time we address the employment issue, and I am going to do that. Let me talk briefly about the point Jonathan raised. About 12 years ago, we have had in California, by the way, for close to 40 years, what we call a Committee on Employment Assistance within CCB. For the last 20 years, that committee has operated an equipment loan fund for blind persons who needed adaptive tech to go to work, or any kind of tech to go to work, and couldn't get the Department of Rehab to provide it. But as part of the committee's activities in the late 80s, I did an employment survey. And what I discovered and it wasn't a great sample. I didn't have the wherewithal to do that. But within that the sample, and there was something close to 100 to 120 participants in the survey, what we found was that the unemployment rate was right around 50%. Not 70, but 50%. There have been surveys, however, the Harris surveying people and also I think some information gleaned from the 1990 census and AFB, American Foundation of the Blind, that the unemployment rate is somewhere around 70 to 73% for persons who are blind and visually impaired. The statistics for the disability population as a whole actually are slightly higher now than prior to the enactment of the ADA. I don't even want to speculate on that one now. We can address that at some other point. But I want to talk for a minute about the issue that I've raised and Bill alluded to here, personal responsibility versus public perception. Yeah, I do believe we can change public perception. And the reason I believe that is that for the last 20 years, I've been doing disability awareness training for a program called Tilting at Windmills. I've done it training both in the as a city employee, when I ran our training operations, and also as a private consultant, taking my vacation time and running around the country and doing some training. And it's an attitudinal awareness program. Many of you may have heard of it. And I know that people have changed their perceptions about disability generally and comments regarding blindness particularly. I do believe you can change public perception, but I think it's a whole lot easier to change it one person at a time. And That's where I think the issue of personal responsibility comes in. I echo Bill and Naomi's sentiments. Just because we don't see doesn't mean we can get away with some of the things that we know we do. My mother, the first time my mother caught me rocking as a 7 or 8 year old, she threatened mayhem that would have had her turned into protective services had I not stopped right then and there. And the fact, you know, the issue came up a couple of years ago. One of the candidates for office was criticized, for ACB office, was criticized for not being very hygienic. I think that's disgraceful that anybody in this organization who's assuming a leadership position doesn't look his or her best, just like anybody who is in the looking for a job out in the public doesn't look his or her best. And there seems to be a reluctance among rehabilitation personnel to raise those issues to people, for a counselor to say to a client, do you know that what you're wearing, your top and your bottom, the colors clash? Do you know that I can tell you haven't washed your hair in 3 days? Do you know that I can tell you've got a 5 o'clock shadow and it's 10 o'clock in the morning? I think we have a responsibility. I was raised to believe that you had to be. It wasn't enough to be just as good as the next person, as the sighted person. You had to be a little bit better. And I don't think that's changed a hell of a lot since 1990. Do I have another 30 seconds, Peter?
Yes, go ahead.
And the other thing I want to say, talking about perception and dealing with blind people, the two best supervisors I've ever had were my first one and my last one, my current one. My first supervisor, who actually hired me for the city in 1975, had dealt with blind people previously because he had been a counselor at an agency that worked with blind and visually impaired kids and teenagers in Los Angeles for a number of years. So he was comfortable with blind people. My current boss, who is also a very good friend now, she went to one of the high schools in the LA Unified School District where blind and visually impaired high schoolers went. It was a resource program. In fact, had they not split the program up the year before I was to go there, putting some of us who lived in a part of LA in one school, we would have been classmates. But Sharon was used to interacting with blind kids, and a lot of them that she knew were very, very smart and very capable. So when she became our director 2.5 years ago, she knew that some of us were good and some of us were a pain in the ass, and that, you know, we were like everybody else, and she didn't have some of those misperceptions about blindness that most everybody else has. So exposure is very, very important. And I'll quit.
There it is.
Yeah, right.
Got it. Thank you, panel. A lot of interesting things said. One common theme that I've heard is the whole issue of the responsibility of being your best when you're in a professional situation, whether it be a job interview or at work or in an ACB officer, for that matter. So the social personal responsibility came up. I thought Bill's comments about the issue of public perception and the whole issue of stereotyping and the complexities were extremely well stated and accurate. But as this issue is often the case, these raise more questions than answers. And what I would like to challenge us to do during the next block of time, panelists and the rest of us in this room, is to think more in the lines of solutions. What are things that we can do to improve the situation a little bit? We aren't going to solve the problems of the world the next 5 seconds, but we might be able to do something, you know, to help things move along. There have been a number of suggestions. Mitch's idea of establishing an employment committee is a great one. But the first question I'd like to address, because I think it's the issue that I heard that came up the most commonly, was the issue of, we all of us in this room know that there are some people among us who have difficulties with hygiene or social skills or whatever you want to call it. But it's a hard thing to communicate. You know, how do we communicate to a person that he smells? You know, how do you do that? My guess is there's a lot of talent in the room. And what I would ask is for people to give examples of where they've been successful or, you know, possible ways of us thinking about this issue in a different way. Let's focus on this issue of how to communicate sort of bad news to people. What's that about? Any reactions or comments? Please.
Get to
can you get to a mic somehow?
Right here. I'm Madam Mike.
Yeah.
I'm Darian Hartman. And as a job developer, one thing I think that is helpful in any form of counseling or working with people is building on strengths. And I think to start with the positive and then address the issue. So all of us have our own talents and gifts, and even the people that we work with that need jobs, that have issues to work on, we can find a gift or a positive in them and start by praising them for that and assuring them that we value them as people, and then go on to be very honest and not mealy-mouthed about the issues that we see that they need to work on, but do this in a supportive I'm in this with you, and I believe in you, and if we work on this together, we can work with it.
So the idea of preaching doesn't work too well. But the idea of establishing a relationship makes some sense to me.
One of the things that I did as an employment specialist was I would take individuals shopping, and I would also get makeup, a makeup analysis done, and I would work with the individual at the store, whoever I was dealing with, and teach them how to teach a blind person how to put on makeup. And I did this a lot with individuals that I knew were going on interviews, and it was a really good experience because at the end of the day, they felt so much better about themselves, and I got a lot of positive feedback that they had never had such positive feedback themselves. So I found that to be a real good positive way of helping with some of this.
So being part of the solution.
Correct.
Is a big one.
Peter?
Yes.
This is Billie Jean. I learned as a sort of 20-ish year old that blind people are very visible, whether it's for the good or the bad, are the ugly or whatever, and someone who's very near and dear to me has written letters to the forum about some of the issues you're just discussing, and the feedback has been very negative. People have said that he had no right to do this, that's horrible, that the people that were he was writing about should have been informed. Well, the people he was writing about had been informed for years and still ignored some of the things that people who meant well were trying to say to help them, because we care about them. And this thing about being visible, if you are a blind person, no matter what, people are going to notice you. So why don't they notice you for positive things rather than some of the things that we just shiver to think about? So that's my comment.
Yeah, that interest, the issue about being constantly visible is a real one, right? We're, you know, walking down the street. Oh, here's that guy with a cane, or here's that guy with a dog. If we're not careful, he's going to knock us over. You know, that stuff's out there, and we have some control over that. But
Peter,
the truth, yeah.
Peter, let me make one comment.
Please.
Specifically in response to Billie Jean and a couple of other folks who've mentioned it indirectly.
I am a person who doesn't always want to be on display. I make a very strong distinction between when I'm in my professional capacity and when I'm just hanging out. Now, that doesn't mean I don't shower on the weekends.
You don't?
No, I do. What it does mean is that when I'm going to work, I'm always in a coat and tie. I do at least as good as any man does at matching clothes. I've had this argument with folks, women particularly, who are really into matching up this shade of rose and that shade of lavender. But, you know, but on the weekends, if I don't have anything planned, you know, I don't mind going a day or two without taking a shave. But again, there are times, and I think we do have to make a distinction between when we are, you know, going out in public and representing ourselves, our organization, whatever, and when we just want to hang out. And I think it's important because we are on display most of the time. But it's also very important sometimes to be able to say, I'm off duty. That's why a lot of us, I fear some of us come to conventions and kind of let it all hang out because they're tired. They don't want to be on display, and they think this is an opportunity for them not to be. But you know, I think it is important to look your best and be professional. But there are also times when I want to be, you know, I want to look like Joe Sixpack, too.
Yeah, but whether you want to or not, we're still on display, and that's sort of the challenge.
It's true.
That's the challenge.
Peter?
Yes.
Linda Yax from Colorado.
Hi, Linda.
Couple things. One, I don't know if you guys realize that we've gotten a lot of media coverage this week, and realizing that, I began to think a little harder about how I looked when I got up in the morning because that TV camera might just be through here. And I certainly didn't want to be the one they pointed to and said, poor blind lady, she doesn't know, she's got a stain on her shirt. But anyway, I worry about those kinds of things a lot, and I bet you a lot of us do. You hear how hard other people work to get stains out of their clothes, and I think, oh my gosh, it's either not really that difficult or I look terrible, one of the two. The comment I wanted to make, though, that brought me up here was we have a program in Denver. It's called the Computer Training for Persons with Disabilities Program, which is neither here nor there, except that what I want to tell you about that program is one of the things that they do is their college students are not allowed to come to school looking like your average college student. They have to dress every day just like they were going to a high-powered, high-paying computer position. They're expected to show up in coats and ties and shirts and skirts and to look every day like they were going to that professional job that they want to be considered for when they finish that training. And I'm wondering if it would be in the best interest of rehab counselors or whoever else is actually doing job training to start requiring that their students look like they're going to look every day when they go on the job so that two things happen. One, the bad habits can be pointed out to them in a kind, slow way so that not everything has to change at once. And two, so they become good habits. Excuse me, I don't care whether you like my idea or not. So that when they do go out on the job... Is that you? Oh. Why?
Is that Liz?
Gee, we're in public.
Is this family dissension?
I guess. She doesn't like to be groomed. Maybe that's it. Especially her tail. I can't believe she barked. That's not like her.
She's just agreeing with you, Linda.
We thank you, Linda, for your comments. They were very inspiring.
Peter.
Did somebody?
Yes.
Okay.
This is Donna.
Yes, Donna.
In terms of solutions that we were trying to discuss here, I think that we have to be really willing and open to share information. A lot of the information that people with vision have about appearance and whether things match and what hair looks like, et cetera, you know, they get that visually through looking through magazines, watching television, watching movies, seeing each other, seeing what works, what gets attention, what doesn't get attention. And we don't get it that way. And so, you know, I was fortunate enough to have two older sisters who made sure I got it one way or another. But we have to be willing to share that verbally with other blind people. We have to be willing to maybe write some things about it. The task force Mitch mentioned earlier sounded like a really excellent idea to try to get that information out. But we don't get it visually, so we have to make sure that we find some other method of sharing it.
Thank you, Don. Any further comments about this issue of hygiene?
Peter.
Yeah, one more.
This is Roger Keeney from Athens, Georgia.
Can you get to a mic, please,
Roger?
Well, I just got to get closer
to the mic.
That's
better. That's better. That's great.
You're doing it now. Issue of this appearance, again, the same as my theme was before. It needs to start before we're adults. We need to get into our schools as volunteers. We need to get these many of these teachers, these public school teachers, and get them over their fear of confronting some of these issues with children with visual and disabilities, and to get it started there. Additionally, we have to be. I've been a Gestalt therapist for a number of years, and so I don't mince words. And while I was employment services coordinator for the center. For Independence of the Disabled out in Belmont, California, same thing. I didn't mince words. People were there. Their complaint was, I can't get a job. My response was, well, you know, who's going to hire you looking or smelling or whatever like you do? Think about it. But I think I can help you change that. And When we're at a point where we're looking for a job, it's in my opinion, I don't have time to spend 3 weeks developing a relationship so that I can approach the subject. Let's look at the problem, outline the solution, and find the answers. And I believe this should start in school and
pardon me? I know what you're talking. Well, maybe Margie or I know which program you're talking about. But if anyone from the state of Texas want to talk about what the commission does or Margie,
I'm right here.
If you can find a microphone, please do it.
Where's the microphone?
Anybody know where the
here
mic
you go.
Is?
Here you go.
There's.
Just a second. We're here.
Okay.
No.
I'll let you go.
Okay. That's good.
I was part of that program in Texas before I left.
Cool.
Your name? This is Sarah.
Oh, hi, Sarah.
Hi. And from been there and done that point of view, it was really good for me as a teenager. I also had parents who were very socially conscious and taught me to be well-dressed everywhere I went. And that was all a very good thing. The other thing that Texas has done is to set up actual summer work experiences for teenagers where they place the teenagers in a job site. And that's good. Unfortunately, I can't say that it helps a lot 10 years down the road, because there are other problems that crop up that are sometimes not dealt with.
Mr. Chairman.
I want to talk about the program in California.
Okay, hold on for 2 seconds. Sarah?
Well, we have to lower it again.
Sorry about that. I'm sort of torn as to how to proceed with this. Sarah, can you just say a few words about, you know, you went through this program, you found it useful, the sort of difficulties that the program didn't address?
Coping with discrimination.
Ah, okay.
Because there are employers out there who have their own agendas, and they will stop at nothing.
Yep.
And they have no regard for the laws. And when you can't get those laws enforced because the EEOC sends you around and around and around until your statute runs out, and you have no money. They tell you you can sue, but you have no money. There is no closure. And that makes it hard to go and keep looking and keep looking when you get the same problems over and over. And it's hard to keep answering, how are you going to do this when nobody cares?
Mr. Chairperson.
First of all, thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate your comments. I really, really do. Yeah. You are?
They're adjusting the mic, so I'm a little taller than Sarah. I want to talk about the program.
Before you do that, who's speaking?
I'm sorry, Margie Donovan.
Thank you, Margie.
I worked with the Summer Transition Program for a number of years, which is held at the California School for the Blind, where they bring high school and college-age students in, college-bound students, to spend, I think it's 3 weeks. And one of the components I worked in was setting up a role model situation where a young child, one of the students in the program, would go home with blind adults. They would show up at their job Friday morning, go home with them, spend the weekend, go back to their job on Monday, and then go back to the program Monday afternoon. And I just want to tell of a story that I had with the young lady when my first year. It was the most awesome experience. I happened to have an infant son, and I had a young lady and a young man. We got to my house on Friday night. I said, okay, we're going to have fun this weekend. We're going to go to the movies tomorrow, but somebody's got to cook dinner tonight. Who's doing what? And I threw them right in there, and I said, okay, somebody's got to bathe the baby. Who's doing that? And made them accountable the whole weekend. And, yeah, we went and did some fun things, too. I didn't make them cook all weekend. But I actually did not reorganize my weekend. I had them do what I normally would do on the weekends. And I think that we could begin some of that right here in ACB. We have NAPFI here, and we've got competent blind adults that could begin working with those children, playing with those children, and role modeling. Each of us, when we go home, can find a blind child and be a big sister, big brother. It's one of my dreams. Why does the hearing impaired community have a grant with big sisters and big brothers for deaf role models, but the blind community does not? And the final thing I want to say, actually, two things real quick. The other thing I want to say is I think every blind adult needs a sighted person in their life to keep them up to date on fashion. There's more change for women, but it's very important to help us and remind us and tell us what people are wearing. And the other thing I want to say is, I just forgot it.
Well, Margie, we thank you very much. I want to turn a corner because I think what Sarah articulated is really real. We haven't talked about it very much. And we obviously can't solve the discrimination that is out there. We can't do, you know, we're not going to change that tomorrow. But I would like us to ponder a little bit. What do we do? I mean, you know, all of us have had this experience in one way or another. God knows I have. You know, when you've been discriminated against, and we're talking about employment situations here. We're not talking about the other issues, which are also real. But what can we do to support each other in this, or the community, or what legislation? What can we do to address that issue? I think it's an important one. We can at least try to grapple
Peter,
a little bit. Yeah.
There's an expression that says bad cases make bad law. Bill Lewis referenced in his statement that most discrimination cases are found in favor of the employer. In my checkered career with the city, I spent several years as a complaint investigator. And my experience was that the people with legitimate cases of discrimination tended not to choose to file. They didn't want to rock the boat and cause trouble. The people who had gripes against their supervisor or against the city or just had a bad attitude were the ones who typically filed. And that's by way of saying that people like you, Sarah, need to come to us in ACB so we can help you. We have in the organization an advocacy services committee. I happen to sit on it. And we helped one woman last year who had been discharged by her bank. Her employer was a bank in Oregon. The bank let her go because they said the Oregon Commission won't guarantee that this piece of equipment will work, and we can't take the chance, so goodbye. And the EEOC did not find in her favor. And that's a whole other issue, but the EEOC people, a lot of their investigators, are not aware, familiar with what blind people can do. Therefore, a lot of these cases get dismissed. But what you need to do, and what people like you need to do, who have these kinds of situations, is you need to talk to us, because perhaps we can help, because good cases can make good law.
Could I make
There is a woman, as I understand, on the far left back. Is that you?
That
oh, yeah,
me.
Kathy.
Yeah.
Would you like to say a few words?
Yes, I would.
Please.
I think that self-esteem is one of the most important things that affects you when you're trying to get a job, and I think your attitude counts, too. I think we have an excellent opportunity here if we incorporate Mitch's idea that we have an employment group through a seminar next year or a workshop through ACB and Margie's. We can start with NAPI to work with the children. But I really think that we had Pam Shaw once in California to work with us on some of the things she did about attitudes of people in chapters. That could be applied to people trying to find a job or finding out about taking care of themselves and keeping themselves up, looking proper, and all the rest of it. I think that if we had a workshop next year and had Pam do something like that with people, I would a lot rather have a group setting like she had. She had a group of people interact, and they would put on a little skit. And they didn't have any script. They just came up and did what we're doing. But it's much better to have somebody make, you know, to tell you, you know, talk to somebody, you know, friend, you gotta take a shower. I think, you know, here's a cake of soap, you know, something. Anyway, it can be worked out. And I think that you can do much better approaching people that way. You can get people's attention and bring it home. And I think that we should have something like that in ACB. We should devote some time to it. This is one of the things I find pretty exciting. I like to go away from a convention feeling that I've learned something and see something new coming that we really need, and I feel like this is. And I would like to see us incorporate that, start with NAPI, meet with the kids, bring the parents in with us when we have this kind of discussion, and I think that we can help each other and we should help each other. And I hope that out of this today will come a recommendation that we do spend some time on this in ACV. I'd a lot rather hear about this, and I, you know, I'm sorry, I don't want to be stepping on anyone's toes, but it seems to me I come to convention, I'm beginning to hear the same song, third verse, quite often, and I'd like to get on to some new songs and some new verses, and I think this would be one, and I'm just very pleased with what you're doing today.
Peter?
I have a positive suggestion.
Pam, are you game? Good, 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 good. We'll remember that.
Peter, I'll even bring the soap.
Yes. Who's speaking?
Billie Jean.
Yes, Billie Jean.
Somebody, I have a positive suggestion that I've noticed at some of the state affiliate meetings that I've been to. I know one year they had a fashion consultant from Marshall Fields, and it was so popular. She came in and gave assessments to people about their dress and about some suggestions for people depending on their height and things like that. And then another one that I think was at ACB a couple of years ago was a consultant on makeup and one on body language, and that was very popular. People, the women especially, wanted to go, well, makeup, yes. But for the body language and things like that, I think some of those just personal things that you can get someone who knows about it to tell you is can be a very positive thing for an idea for workshops.
I seem to recall Friends in Art doing something similar last year, Gordon, which was quite successful.
One thing I... this is a discussion.
Is this Paulette Chapman, by the way?
No.
Paulette, can you go on then? Artist, you're next.
My name is Paulette Bartelt, and I work for Estate Independent Living Center. And in our state, in our independent living center, this gets into several sections we've been talking about. We offer twice a year a job club where any member of the community with a disability can participate. We've had very good luck with our relationship with the Badger Association, who I'm also a member of, in this job club. And we have trained in the training. It's everything from educating somebody on what they're entitled to as a person with a disability, what their rights are in employment, what discrimination is, and what kinds of questions an employer can or cannot ask. We also go into things like how to present yourself in an interview, how hygiene plays a role in that, and we also have done, as an independent living coordinator, I have had a woman call me, tell me she could not make her appointment with me, had a job goal, but the thing she said to me was, I'm sorry, I don't think I can make it in today because I haven't showered in the last week. And these are the kind of situations that we sometimes get in this profession when we're working with people with disabilities, and we have to learn to do that very subtly and present it to them in a way. It's what I've done in the past. I sat down with the person and said, okay, you're interested in employment. These are some of the ramifications if you don't change what you're doing, and worked with them on how they could do it in a cost-effective way. For example, we've done trips to Salvation Army to pick out work wardrobes and suits to a job interview and some of those kinds of things, but also some things that they can do throughout the day, like having handy wipes and some of those things at their desk. So if they do perspire a lot, take a break in the bathroom and do some of those hygiene things for a few minutes. And that has been very successful for the group of people I have worked with in the past.
We thank you. There's somebody else, and I forgot who the next person was. Somebody told me, and I forgot.
I've been standing here at the mic
you
for
are?
Several minutes. I'm Darian.
Oh, yeah, please, Darian. You are next. Good.
Okay. Self-disclosure and whether or not you're going to reveal that you're visually impaired or not before the interview is such a personal, controversial choice. But I just want to talk about being prepared for that interview. And what I have recommended to clients and what I have done in my own job search, it's all part of the package. You have to be prepared for the interview by taking in your tools with you, by demonstrating them and not saying, well, you need to know what the accommodations are. You show by example what the accommodations are. This is the equipment I will use for my job. And what that does is it puts them at ease about your visual impairment because you take the initiative to talk about it yourself. And I want to address what Sarah said. And I know how discouraging it is to apply and interview and be rejected and interview and be rejected. And I've been through it. And there were so many days when I didn't want to get up and do my job search. But the days when I got up and did my job search and sent out resumes, I got called in for interviews. And no matter how discouraged you get, part of the life experience is going out and doing it again. And I would just encourage people to not let that discrimination issue get you down, because the more you do it, the more you're going to feel good about yourself. The whole thing about self-esteem is the more you practice what you want, the better you get at it.
I have a question for you, Darian. Is that your name?
Yes.
Before you, and thank you for your comments. I appreciate your honesty about the comment about, you know, there are some days you just didn't feel up to doing what you needed to do. Can you talk about how you sort of got through that? How'd you do that? How'd you get through those kinds of valleys, if you will? What did you do? How did you survive that?
You know what? I just did it. I just got up and said, I'm going to research and make my phone calls and write my letters, whether I feel like doing it or not, because it seems to me in my life what has gotten me through is acting as if. Sometimes you just have to act as if, because pretty soon it isn't an act as if thing anymore. It's a real, you become self-validating because you get results from what you do. And if you sit back, stay in bed, say nobody wants to hire me, that's exactly what's going to happen. Nobody will hire you. But
I'm sorry. Thank you. I didn't mean to cut you off. Sorry about that.
That's fine.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. I think the challenge that we, as folks who have been moderately successful in the workplace, is how do we help folks get through those valleys? And I'm just going to leave the question out, but there are folks who want to talk. One of them is the panelists have been remarkably quiet, but Bill had wanted to say something about something, and I'd like Bill to say something.
Yeah, I was just listening to what the group had in mind. There are several things I want to observe, because I worked 40 years in the field, and I changed job settings 5 times, had to go through 4 universities to get that far, and then retired at what I considered the top of the heap. But during my working career, I did not encounter prejudice. All the employers I worked for were extremely cooperative. The question is why. One reason is the selection process. The first 10 minutes of the interview, we knew we were meant for each other or we weren't. I ruled out the places I felt uncomfortable and I thought were going to give me a hard time. But I was lucky because whenever I did exclude one, there was another waiting that I could go to that worked out for me. So in order to get to where you want to go, one of the things that was brought out is, first, you got to be well prepared. And I think most of us who've done well feel like we are. Also, in addition to being well prepared, we have to be prepared to learn what we don't already know. And that has to be very clear to anyone we're going to work for. But then there's the matter of luck and timing and the people you work for. Sometimes you have to go the extra mile to get along with somebody. And sometimes other people go the extra mile trying to get along with us if we're giving them a hard time. But the grooming thing, the preparation thing, the attitude thing all work together to create what is called a personality or an aura that we present to others. And I think one of the things that keeps people from being able to get the jobs they're looking for, even though they're maybe well prepared for it, is there's an attitude. They got a sign on their back that says, kick me. And when people see that sign, they have a tendency to kick them. I think confidence is nothing more than an attitude that is learned. In role playing, we can learn it through role playing. We can learn it by watching other people. There are a lot of ways we can do it. But I see some of you out there feel like you've done pretty well. Some of you having trouble. And I don't know what causes us to sometimes for things to go well and sometimes not. There've been a couple of times I was asked to resign, but I've also gone into interviews where people were kind of I don't know what the attitude. It was a bad attitude. I just didn't like it. But those things happen if you have to persist. I remember Deborah Kendrick telling a story one time of how she went for a job interview, and as soon as she walked in and the employer saw she was blind, he grabbed her by the arm, turned her around, and pushed her right back out the door again, saying no, 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 no. But she persisted, and she's doing very well today. And anyway, persistence is something that a lot of visually impaired people don't seem to have.
Thanks, Bill.
Bill, I'd like to comment.
Mitch, before you do that, was that Mitch who spoke?
No.
Who was that?
This is Roger Keene.
Okay, Roger, hold on for 2 seconds. Naomi has to leave us, and I'd like to give her a chance to say a few words before she leaves, since she's one of the panelists. So, Naomi, could you say
I just wanted to say I really have been very impressed with the comments that have been made. Darian, I feel like that we must have talked sometime in our life, because a lot of the things that you have said are things that I have said to individuals, and it is the same approach that I have used. So, I would like, you know, one of the things that I remember, which is really important to me growing up, there were people in my life, I think, that I would consider mentors in my life at different points that really helped me with my, quote, self-esteem. I mean, my family, my first O&M instructor when I was in eighth grade, certain people that really made a difference to me. But
My interview with IBM was a real hard one for me to get, but I was very much, I pursued that very, very, just really pursued that pretty hard. And I had a manager who was just wonderful. And what he told me, which I don't remember to this day, but he always said to me, anytime I do a public event or speak about employment, he'd say, don't forget to tell the story of how you got interviewed or what happened, how I hired you. And what he said to me was, we went out for lunch during this interview. And I remember going to the elevator with him, and he said to me, Naomi, I've not had a lot of experience with people who are blind. And I said, don't worry. This is what he said. I said, I do not remember to this day. He said, Naomi, you said to me, don't worry, I'm a good educator. He said, then I knew immediately I was going to hire you. And I'll never forget that, and I don't remember saying that to this day. But I truly feel in my life that my role is to educate people, whether I like it or not, and that my role is to make my appearance and my demeanor such that the next blind person who comes along, that they will be treated better because of the way that I came across. And I think that's my whole life philosophy. So, anyway, I wish everybody the best of luck in whatever you're doing.
Thanks, thanks,
Mr. Chair,
Naomi.
Peter, I just want to say before Naomi leaves, no, it's to Naomi. You're one of the people that's I want as part of this Employment Issues Committee, so you'll be hearing from me.
I know I will.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, indeed. We are running sort of out of time, and I know there are folks who want to speak. Was there a Keenan or something? Is he still there?
Roger Keeney.
Can you say a few words, and I want to sort of wrap it up?
Very few.
I haven't forgotten you. Go ahead.
I wanted to make two comments. One to the issue that Bill and the previous speaker were speaking about in being ready, self-confidence, and all that. Part of the thing in our job preparation teaching to convey is that you're not asking the employer for a favor, you're selling him a service. And if we can get folks, the prospective employee, to view their own abilities as valuable services to sell the employer, the confidence comes across. This works very well. The other point that I wanted to make, yes, we've made a lot of points about our side. One of the points we haven't made is to how to tell enough employers that we as a group are available and skilled and have are valuable employees. And one of the ways that I've had success in this is in a couple of places that I was director of a Center for Independent Living. I've worked, in places like that. With our local Chamber of Commerce, had them print a few of the people that we had available to go to work, little short summaries of the resume right in the Chamber of Commerce newsletter. And that changed the attitude of the employers in the whole area, all the members. Within a few months, they were looking for employees among people with disabilities and not instead of turning them away. So we need to get the word out.
And we thank you. We need to wrap this up. I want to make a couple of comments, and first of all, I want to apologize for those of you who didn't get a chance to speak or who wanted to speak or whatever. I do want to say, folks, a couple of things. One of the things that struck me this year at the convention is something I've heard at the sports lunch, I've heard at the swimming something at Friends in Art put on, and here. What is required in this employment thing and to be some degree of success are two things. One is personal responsibility, which we've talked a lot about, and the other thing is somebody who believes in us enough, each individually, to work with us, to improve us in a way to make us more effective in whatever it is we're trying to do. We need both. If we don't have both, we ain't going to be successful. So I think our challenge, and it's already been stressed here, is to be effective mentors, coaches to those who are struggling. You know, it isn't probably going to work to say just keep on going. We got to find ways of helping folks who are struggling with these issues of discrimination or depression or whatever issues we're dealing with here.
Yeah,
it's not easy. I know Carla wants to make a brief advertisement. Carla, are you around someplace?
Yes, I'm right there.
Can you
right
quickly here. Talk about your thing, and then we'll
yes,
and then I'll turn the floor
I
to
I have
Mitch.
A product that is available that you may be interested in that really addresses this. I'm the chairperson of the Pennsylvania Employment Committee, so that's how this developed. But anyhow, it's called the EQ test, an assessment tool for blind job seekers. And what it is it's a 78-statement inventory that you take to measure your job readiness in some of the blindness issues. There's a whole section just for blindness issues, another section for professional, and another section for personal issues, such as organizational skills and all of that. And the test is available either on a cassette or a diskette for $15. And I will hang around here in the front of the room for a few minutes till after this segment is over. But I'd also like to say that I do it as a workshop, and I'd be willing to do it as part of an employment type of an affair. We've done it with the Employment Committee successfully in Pennsylvania during our employment seminars, and I'd be willing to offer my services to do that.
Thank you, Carla.
And if you need to get in touch with me, I'm in room 1503. If you can't get the test here, you want to do it later, you know, you can do that too. Thanks.
1503. Thanks, Carla.
Marriott.
Okay. I want to thank you for allowing me to be part of this process. I found it really interesting and useful, and I hope this continues. I hope this is the first step in making this a more high profile issue for ACB. So I thank you all for coming. Before you leave, Mitch has to say a few words about personal responsibility.
Yes,
Mitch.
Before the folks who are only staying for the employment roundtable leave, I'm going to put the ball in your court. I asked Peter to break at 3:40 rather than 3:45 for a reason. I'm going to give you both my work telephone number and my work email address. Those of you who want to be listed as interested in serving on an employment issues committee, some of us, because I have them with me, may have brought business cards. I have some business cards, although they're not in Braille. I'll own up to that, because I don't typically give out my business card at work to other blind folks, and I should do that. But I do have my business cards here. But I'm going to give out an email address and a phone number. But any of you also who have business cards, I'm going to ask, and who want to be part of this endeavor, I'll give a couple of minutes, have folks come up to the front here. Here is where I am, because you sure as hell can't tell on the microphone. I am at your left hand. There are two tables up here, and I'm to the left of the podium. So if anyone has business cards, I'm going to take this recommendation forward to the board Saturday, and I'd like to have 8 or 10 names. Those of you who don't have business cards, which probably means most of you, you can email me. If you have your laptops here, you can leave me an email at my office, or you can email or call me Monday. Your personal responsibility is to remind me that you want to do this. Okay. First of all, my phone number, because as I said during our business meeting, one phone call is a whole hell of a lot faster than 3 or 4 emails back and forth. Phone number at work is area code 213-847-9124. 213-847-9124. It is a direct line. My email address is mpomerantz, M-P-O-M-E-R-A-N-T-Z, at mailbox, one word, dot LACity, LACITY, dot org. We're an organization, we're not government. So, mpomerantz at mailbox.lacity.org. If you are interested in participating in an employment issues committee, or 213-847-9124, or you can come up now and give me your business card. I thank those of you very much who are only staying for the employment roundtable. I hope you stay longer, because the next program, I think, will be equally as informative. So with that, thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, yes. Okay, Julie, why don't you take Peter's... well, can you help her? I cannot. I'm asking Skip if you can help. I'm about to move my dog so you can sit there, Julie.
And I'm just not sure how long this break is, but just a reminder that if you do have any questions, I do actually have access to a mic for the next part of the proceeding, so you can email convention@acbradio.org, and I'll see if I can get the floor for you if you have any comments or questions about the 508 workshop, which is about to take place. So that's convention@acbradio.org. You're listening to afternoon live coverage from the 40th annual convention of the ACB in Des Moines, Iowa, the seminar being presented by the ACB governmental employees. Mitch Pomerantz in the chair, and we are just taking a brief break, I think, before the workshop on section 508, and we'll be back with that in just a moment. Following this coverage, of course, the archive will continue of today's proceedings from the convention, and at 8 a.m. on Friday morning we will resume from Des Moines. And at that time we hope to hear from ACB President Paul Edwards, or perhaps a little after that, to take us through the procedure that will be enforced for tomorrow's election of officers. Yes, tomorrow is finally election day at ACB. And you will be able to hear the elections taking place live. Also, if you would prefer, Marlena Lieberg, who I'm pleased to say is back in action, and unfortunately not at the convention though, but she will be broadcasting her program The Softer Side on ACB Radio Interactive at the time that the convention is on, and we'll be receiving the results as soon as they come in, so you can listen to her wonderful music and get the results still on ACB Radio Interactive. But if you're one of those political junkies that wants to follow it all, as I am, then you can tune in right here to ACB Radio Mainstream for the action, and I can promise you there will be no early calling, no exit polls. So the result will be accurate when you get it first. Tonight is the Candidates Forum, and we will not be broadcasting that due to logistical issues of where the Candidates Forum is being held, but there's a lot of anticipation about that. This is the forum that the Board of Publications runs in order to help people to get exposure to the candidates, ask questions, and Jay Doudna, I understand, will be chairing that, a member of the Board of Publications, and that's over at the Marriott, so we're unable to stream it, but there's... as I said, a lot of anticipation about that this evening, the Candidates Forum, starting at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow evening, ACB Radio Mainstream will be broadcasting from the banquet, and although the banquet itself starts at about 7, I would think around about 8 o'clock Central Time, give or take a bit, so that will be 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific, 1 o'clock on Saturday morning Universal Time, is when we begin the banquet entertainment, which this year comes from ACB Radio Interactive, and we can promise you there'll be lots of interesting stuff there, sorry, ACB Radio in general, but there will be an announcement from ACB Radio Interactive as part of that banquet entertainment, which I'm sure you will find tantalizing. So we'll got this, what, just over 24 hours to go, and you'll be able to hear all the details about that. And then we conclude on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock with the final general session, and that will pretty much go until the business is done, maybe a little later than midday, because there are resolutions which have been brought to the floor, and all resolutions must come to the full convention. and there'll be debate. And then there'll be the reflections, of course, of Paul Edwards as he officiates over his final ACB gathering as president. A reminder that we will be taking your email comments, either questions for the panel that's going to be talking about Section 508, or anything that you may want asked. We are delighted to hear from you. We've been really delighted with the many emails we've received.
Yes.
Anticipating any audience participation in this
one? Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. Good afternoon again. Welcome to part two of the program sponsored by ACB Government Employees. This one has to do with Section 508. And it's an issue of specific concern to those of us who are in the federal, who work in federal government, but more generally to all of us who deal with access technology. I said during our business meeting that one of the things that has been talked about in some circles is the possibility of state legislation requiring state government to do exactly what the federal government is now required to do. Hopefully I'm not stealing Julie's thunder, but I hope she'll elaborate on that, because I do believe that it's a viable option. State governments are large purchasers of technology, just as the federal government is. So that is certainly something that we need to look at. Now, the program said Doug Wakefield was going to be joining Julie Carroll today, but Doug had to go back yesterday. So Doug is not here, but Julie Carroll is. I also want to mention for the folks who did not join us for the first session, too bad, but the program, both of these programs, and I'm very honored that we were asked to do this, both of the programs are being carried on ACB Radio.
Mr. Chairman.
Is that Mac?
This is Jonathan from ACB Radio.
Jonathan.
I just wanted to chime in and say that we've had an email from Debbie Cook, who is listening, and she says that she'll be happy to chime in via email if she can help in any way with the 508 discussions.
Julie is in conversation here. Did you hear that, Julie? There was an email from Deb Cook, who is listening and will help if need be. So thank you, Debbie. Sorry you aren't here. I had called Debbie originally to be part of this little soiree, but she was unable to make the convention this year. So, we are on ACB Radio. Clearly it's working. We've got at least one person listening. So, what I'd like to do now is turn it over to the person who is going to carry the ball for us, if she is ready. Your computer is not cooperating. I will vamp for a minute. Those of you who know me know that I am a very recent user of computer equipment. And so every time I encounter someone like Julie or somebody else who has been doing this since they were 3 or 4 years old, I do have to smile. It does make me feel a little better. She is trying to get her computer to behave. And what is that? Ah, it feels so good when it sounds like one of those sonic alarms that drive our dogs crazy. All right, I think Julie has made a major life decision about how she's going to proceed. Therefore, I am going to turn the program over to a lady who used to be our Director of Governmental Affairs for ACB. She's now with the Georgia Institute of Technology, I think. I've got it. Our folks in Pasadena think that there's only Caltech, but we know better. So I will present to you for her comments and discussion of Section 508, Ms. Julie Carroll.
Thank you. I apologize for the delay. Here we are talking about access to technology, and it's great when it works, but mine won't talk right now. So I want to start by, well, first let me tell you who I am, because the program wasn't quite accurate, and since I keep changing jobs,
I'm sorry.
You'll never find me. Actually, I work for the Information Technology Technical Assistance and Training Center, and it wasn't entirely wrong, Mitch.
Okay.
It's a consortium of five partners. The lead organization is Georgia Tech, and I am the Director of Industry and Government Relations, working on Section 508 and Section 255 implementation. Hence my talk today. I want to start with a little story. Some of you may have heard this already, but it's just sort of an illustration of how far we've come when we talk about access to technology. When my son was doing his math homework one evening, he had a calculator, and he's calculating away, and I noticed it, and I said, "Are you allowed to use a calculator when you do your homework?" And he said, "Of course." And I said, "Are you sure? We weren't allowed to use calculators when I was in the sixth grade."
I had the same
He said,
conversation.
"Mom, they didn't have calculators when you were in the sixth grade."
I had the same conversation with my kid.
And the truth is, I think he's right, unfortunately. And if they had, it wouldn't have been accessible. I think I got my first talking calculator in 1976 or so.
Yeah, that's about right.
$400?
Yeah, telecensory.
Yeah. Well, today we're going to talk about Section 508, and hopefully this is not going to be great news to a lot of you. Hopefully you've been aware of some of these things. I have noticed, though, that there's been a great deal of training and technical assistance for government employees and for the private sector, but I've seen very little done for consumers and employees of the federal government, and so I'm glad to have this opportunity. Section 508, of course, was a part of the amendments to the Rehab Act in 1998. It's not new. Section 508 has been in the Rehab Act since 1986 or thereabout, but it wasn't enforceable, and it didn't have any standards, and it was, for the most part, ignored until this last reauthorization. And Congress strengthened Section 508 significantly this last time around. First, let me tell you what Section 508 requires. It requires that federal departments and agencies will procure, maintain, use, and develop only electronic and information technology that complies with Access Board standards. The main difference between the old 508 and the new 508 is that now we have two enforcement provisions, and we have standards under from the Access Board, and we also have federal acquisition regulations now, which actually incorporate Section 508 into all government procurements. So it is actually happening this time, happening fast. Relationship to other laws. There's been a little bit of confusion about this. We still have Section 504 for program access to services by the government, and we still have Section 501 for reasonable accommodations for federal employees. And what Section 508 does is really just create an accessible environment. It doesn't provide assistive technology at every desk, like some of the media would have you believe. It basically says when someone needs assistive technology and they bring it into the office and plug it in, it needs to work, and your mainstream information technology should work with it. It hasn't been done yet, but it is likely, I think, that the standards under Section 508 would be used as a yardstick in a Section 501 or Section 504 case. So pretty important standards, and probably reaching farther than it appears on their face. The enforcement provisions that were added, there's a complaint process which simply mirrors the Section 504 complaint process. If you're dealing with an agency that's not in compliance, you file a complaint with that agency, and it goes through that way. You don't have to do that. You can go to court and file a lawsuit against the federal department or agency. And you do not have to exhaust your complaint process before you can go to court. So there's no exhaustion requirement. There's another piece of enforcement that's not actually written into the law, but we know it will happen, and that is the bid protest process. And that's a process that's pretty new to most of us in the disability community. It's something the vendors, the information technology vendors, are certainly very familiar with, and that has actually been one of their main concerns about Section 508. When two vendors bid, try to sell something to the government, and the government picks A over B, it's not uncommon for B to file a bid protest and require a complete review of the whole procurement and whether it was appropriate and da-da-da-da-da. Because there's a lot of money at stake here, so they're willing to do that. If they do that under Section 508, of course, Section 508 says you've got to buy the product that's most accessible. So Company A thinks they're most accessible, Company B thinks they're most accessible, and what will happen is they will end up in a bid protest war about accessibility. That ends up in the General Accounting Office. That's who handles bid protests at the federal government level. So it's a process that the disability community needs to watch and try to figure out how to get involved in, because it could ultimately greatly define how Section 508 is really implemented. Let me tell you a little bit about the scope of the standards. The Section 508 standards that came out from the Access Board include basically three main parts. There are technical standards, and there are functional requirements, and then there are requirements for accessible documentation. The technical requirements cover things like access to the web and the internet, access to telecommunications products, access to software and operating systems, access to multimedia, and to self-contained products. Those are sort of the standalone type products that you're not really intended to have to use assistive technology in order to use. Like, for example, a copier or a printer, those kinds of office type equipment. It could also include a kiosk. We're seeing a lot more of those in the government's settings. And probably even ATMs for the federal type credit unions. Also includes standards for desktops and portable computers. So pretty much whatever you need in the workplace in this information age is somehow covered. The functional requirements basically lay out what it is you need to do in order to be accessible for people with vision impairments, hearing impairments, motor impairments, and speech impairments. So those should be interesting and helpful when a company uses the equivalent facilitation mechanism, which I'll talk about a little later. There's also, as I said, documentation requirements. This is going to be interesting to watch how this plays out. Section 508 requires accessible documentation for all products and services. It requires that accessibility and compatibility features be in accessible format, and that any product support or technical support type services also be accessible. The way the law is written, it sort of says you'll have to provide these things at no extra charge upon request. Interesting, at no extra charge, because you don't charge the federal government for these things anyway. I think that might have been a slip in the legislation. I've heard very little bit about this, though, and I suspect that it isn't going to happen right away. I'm not hearing the federal government talking about it, so ultimately they're responsible. They either need to be contracting for all this accessible documentation when they solicit a program, product, or service, or they're going to have to convert it in-house themselves. And so I've been asking, you know, is this on the radar screen? And I'm not sure. So, but it is something you have to request. It's not automatically included. Let me talk for a minute about some of the exceptions. As always, this is not an absolute law. There are a number of exceptions that apply, and industry is very keen on understanding and getting ready to use them. First is undue burden. You're all familiar with undue burden, I think, from the ADA. It's a little different in the Section 508 context in that instead of considering the overall resources available to an agency, you only have to consider the resources available to that specific department or component. I don't know what a component is, but so pretty much narrowed the use of that exception. If there is an undue burden, the agency still has to, of course, meet its 501 obligations to provide reasonable accommodations. It also must still comply with Section 504, and they still have to provide you with comparable information in generally the same time as they do the other employees. So it's not as if they're just off the hook if they have an undue burden. They've got to turn around and figure out how to get you the information in an alternate format that you can use. But it's not as good as, you know, having it at the same time and exactly the same as everybody else, obviously. Also, when there is an undue burden, they must document the extent and the reason for the undue burden. Unfortunately, once they document it, that just goes into a file. They have to keep it on record. It's really about all they have to do. Another exception is fundamental alteration. You might remember that from the ADA. A lot of things are borrowed here from the ADA, as you'll see. Basically, they cannot require a vendor to fundamentally alter its product in order to meet 508 standards. So, for example, if they want to buy an accessible cell phone and to make it talk, would make it so big that it would no longer fit in a pocket or really be portable, that's a fundamental alteration. The next exception is the one that I think is the most interesting and will probably get used a great deal, and that is commercial availability. That is that if what the government procurement people are required to do is market research, they're supposed to go out and find out what products are out there and what accessibility features they have. And if they find a certain accessibility feature that's required under the standards just doesn't exist, then that's an exception, and that's an allowable exception. Commercial availability has three prongs. Basically, it means, is the product out there in time to meet the solicitation, or will it be ready in time to meet the solicitation, or with minor modifications, will there be a product that can meet this solicitation. So it'll be interesting to see how much they use that third one. I don't hear them talking about it. I do hear them talking about the first two. But whether they'll actually require in their solicitations minor modifications to existing products in order to meet 508 will be interesting to see. And, of course, what is a minor modification is yet to be determined. I mentioned the equipment facilitation provision. That's also borrowed from the ADA, and that is a vendor is required to comply with the standards as they are, or they can go off on their own, do their own thing, as long as they can provide the same or greater access in doing so. So that is that's the answer to all the criticism about Section 508 squelching creativity, and we're telling, you know, engineers and web people what to do, and they don't like that. You know, if they can do it better and achieve the same access, they can do that. They're allowed. There are a couple of what I call exclusions. The regulations don't refer to them that way, but these are things that if you have these situations, you don't have to analyze undue burden or commercial availability or, you know, go down any of that road. If you have electronic or information technology that relates to national security, you don't have to comply, period. If you have electronic and information technology that is in work areas that are serviced by personnel only or frequented by service personnel only, that does not have to meet Section 508 standards. That was intended, I think, to get at things like, you know, the heating and air conditioning mechanisms or all those wires in the cabinet that feed to the phone system Those kinds of things are what they intended, but it looks like it may have broader implications. Servers, for example, would be considered work areas frequented by service personnel only, and we, of course, have a lot of blind people working on servers. So hoping that in the next iteration of the standards that can get clarified to include or that exception to exclude those kinds of things where we know we already have people working and there's really no excuse for not requiring accessibility. And the final exception is there's a micro-purchase exception. Turns out that, even Jim Gibbons mentioned this the other day when he was talking, almost a million federal employees have credit cards, federal employee credit cards, and they can just go out to Staples or Office Depot or whatever and make purchases. Well, if they do that and the purchase is less than a $2,500 purchase, they don't have to worry about Section 508. That sunsets, fortunately, by January 2003. And the hope is that by then there will be enough products on the market and that maybe even vendors will be labeling the accessibility features of the products so that anybody going out shopping can find out what those are. There are a number of misconceptions around Section 508. The first of which are the dates. What dates apply? The standards came out in December. They were effective February 21st of 2001. The enforcement provisions went into effect on June 21st, 2001. And the procurement regulations that apply to 508 went into effect on June 25th, 2001. So everybody's confused about what date means what and which one do they need to listen to. Most people are listening to the 25th. The 21st happened to be on a Thursday. 25th is a Monday. Hopefully nobody did anything stupid with buying inaccessible products in between those two dates. But you need to know that it's your right as of June 21st to file a complaint or a lawsuit if someone is not in compliance with Section 508. And that they were supposed to be complying as of February 21st, even though under 508 you couldn't bring a complaint or a lawsuit. But what if, for example, you have a 504 complaint or maybe even an ADA Title II complaint or lawsuit? I think it's very possible that a court would say February 21st was the magic date by which you had to be accessible. But that's just my guess. There's also a lot of confusion about federal funding. Because 504 obligations trickle down according to funding, people assume 508 is the same, but it isn't. If you receive federal funding, but you're not a federal department or agency, you're not covered by Section 508. The companies that do business with the federal government, especially the ones that do a lot of business with the federal government, are confused about whether Section 508 applies to them, especially their websites. It does not. And I have seen on listservs and a lot of other places just a lot of misinformation out there about this. Companies asking, do I have to make my website accessible? And people writing back in saying, well, I'm not a lawyer, but yes, you do. Well, no, they don't. The only way that you would have to do that is if, let's say, a company sells to the government and provides its accessible documentation, product support, for example, and a lot of them are doing that now. Let's say if their way of doing that is on the web, then that part of the web would have to comply with Section 508. Where's my braille? Companies. DOJ, the role of the Department of Justice. Many people think they're the arbiter of 508 complaints for some reason. They are not. They don't have any control over making other federal agencies comply. They don't go around and check and make sure you're complying. Now, they do have some reporting responsibilities. They'll report to Congress on the state of affairs with compliance with Section 508. But at the same time, what their main role would be, if you bring a lawsuit against a federal agency, they will have to be defended by the Department of Justice. So this is a very, I think, a very peculiar arrangement whereby you have the federal agencies who are ultimately potential defendants who really get to write the rules. And if we're not in there making sure those rules work for us and really facilitate 508 implementation, guess how they'll write those rules? We've been trying to watch that, keep an eye on that. And to some extent, the disability community and industry have similar interests in this vein. What the government started out trying to do was basically shift its responsibility to the private sector by having them sign blanket certifications that say, I am Section 508 compliant, period. And nobody wants to sign such a thing, especially at this stage of the game. But we know most products aren't going to be Section 508 compliant. They may have some accessibility features, but it's going to be a long time before anybody out there is comfortable enough with the standard to say, okay, I'm 508 compliant. And so that really tried to shift the burden away from all the homework and marketing research that procurement people in the federal government are supposed to do. So that was one situation where the industry and the disability community were in complete agreement. No, this law applies to federal agencies and departments, and that's who needs to comply and do what they're supposed to do under 508. Lastly, applicability of Section 508 to the states. This is about the most controversial issue with respect to Section 508. It's very confusing. Section 508, as written, if you look at the four corners of the statute, we lawyers like to say, does not apply to states at all. It applies to federal departments and agencies. However, states that receive Assistive Tech Act funds, which so far has been all 50, signed this little tiny paragraph when they got their grant that said, oh, we will also comply with Section 508. They all signed that. So the Department of Education, who has the authority under the Assistive Tech Act to interpret that law, says that means the states have to comply with Section 508. It's a funny situation because they said that before the Section 508 standards came out. And so there are all kinds of due process questions and should have had a rule, a proposed rule and all that for the states to respond to. With the new administration, that position could change. All we have that indicates what that position is right now are two letters that have been issued from the Department of Education, which they have taken off their own website. If you didn't have a copy of one of those letters before, you can't get one now. But there has been no official change in their position. So states don't know what to do. I have been, subtly trying to say, well, gee, if you would petition the Department of Education for clarification on that, maybe, we'd get some guidance. And I fully expect that under this current atmosphere that we would get a different decision out of Department of Education right now. But so far, we've gotten nothing. They're still putting their players in place. So, let me give you a couple of resources on 508 and then move to questions. And we do have Pat Sheehan up here. Because I said, well, what if they start asking technical questions? I'll be in big trouble. So Pat's here for that. And he can probably talk a little bit about what it has meant for federal agencies, from their perspective, to implement Section 508. One more thing I missed. Retrofitting. This is really important. Retrofitting is not required under Section 508. If you've been reading any of the articles in 508 that have been going around in our area, they've actually said, oh, the government's going to shut down web pages on June 21st because they're not going to be accessible, and so they're just going to blacken them out. Well, that's nonsense. Only something that's procured as of June 21st has to be accessible. Now, the government, to its credit, has really been trying to go back and retrofit, but they don't have to do that under 508. Maybe under 504 you could make the argument, but that is not the extent of the enforcement provisions under Section 508. There's some very good resources out there on 508. Let me give you a couple of those. The government has one. It's www.section508.gov. no dashes or hyphens or spaces or anything, just section508.gov. The Access Board has, of course, the standards and also a lot of good information, and that's www.access-board.gov. And then the website of the organization that I work for has a lot of good information on not only 508 but 255 as well, and that is www.ittatc.org. Are there any questions?
There are lots of mics out there.
Hello. This is Mike O'Brien from Troy, New York. What difference would it make that national security is involved? I don't understand why that would, what that would have to do with accessibility, unless the accessibility modification in and of itself compromised national security.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And also the business about service personnel. There might be some service personnel that have disabilities, such as people working on web servers or even people that are doing the more traditional meaning of that have disabilities.
Exactly. Yeah. The national security, those types of things have been exempted from most of the procurement regulations, not just 508. They've sort of had a history of being exempt because they tend to include a lot of sensitive things. And however, the statute says that you cannot exclude things like the accounting system or the payroll system or things that don't have anything really to do with security, even if you're in the military, but they don't really relate to security. They just relate to administration. Those do have to comply with 508 because obviously there are a lot of jobs there that would want to make sure people could get to.
Julie?
Pat wanted to respond.
Yeah. I think I've seen a lot of these questions come up in some of the forums we've had over the country concerning 508. What they're looking at when they're looking just in general are systems like cryptology systems that NSA might be working on. You're looking at systems, let's say, like on fighter aircraft, missile defense, that sort of thing that might be that the military is working on. Like Julie says, any system that's dealing with human resource systems, payroll, anything like that, personnel, all those systems have to comply. The military was under the impression that all their systems were going to be exempt, and now they're trying to come around to making their systems more accessible, and it's quite a process. One of the things Julie hasn't mentioned is that the federal government, as far as trying to implement these requirements, is really, really understaffed. They are at the point now, we are a fairly sophisticated audience, they're at the point now where they're saying, what do you mean by accessibility? So we are trying to educate them right now. Now, as far as employment of disabled people go, one of the things that I have stressed over and over and over again is that the federal government needs to hire people with disabilities. We have the skill set that the federal government needs to be able to test websites, to be able to test equipment. Each agency has a 508 coordinator, and these coordinators are trying to implement 508 in that particular agency. That agency needs to hire people with disabilities. And as far as disabilities go, blindness is a key one because we have access to a lot of good information that the federal government needs.
Julie.
Yes.
Margie Donovan from San Francisco.
Hi.
Question of accessibility and whether or not it falls under Section 508. And many of the VA medical facilities nationwide have a contract with a credit union, a local credit union, to provide an ATM at the medical facilities. And I recently asked about making ours a talking ATM, and the credit union responded to our EEO person that they would have to pull the ATM because it just doesn't make them enough money. Therefore, the solution was to not make it accessible. Would that fall under 508?
You're saying it is a federal government credit union?
I don't think it is a federal government, but the ATM is on federal property.
If it's provided by the federal government would be the issue.
The key here, Margie, would be who procured that
right.
ATM machine.
Exactly.
Let me ask a question.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Mitch has a question.
Thursday, as I was leaving for the convention, I found out that they were installing an ATM in my building. Now, I work for the city, but it is a federal credit union. And I was heading for the credit union at the time, and the manager said, I said, what kind of machine is it? And she said, it's the Diebold, which is the one of the ones that is being installed that is accessible, or at least that company is installing their machines in the three bank locations that we had the suit against in California. If it is a federally chartered credit union, parenthetically, she told me that the equipment would be accessible. It wasn't ready for me to try by the time I left work. But if it's a federally chartered credit union, does that mean it probably has to be accessible, Julie or Pat?
Yes. Yes, because the federal government is providing that either for its employees or the public, used by the public.
So, Margie.
Yes.
There you go. You may want to email me that question. The reason I say is because at Central Office we have a team that we put together, and we've got a procurement person that would be able to answer that question. And also we can check with our legal staff too. And the reason why I think the answer it would be good to be known universally is because of the 230,000 people we have. Your question will be repeated hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. And if we can get an answer to that, not only can we affect, what's happening where you are, but all throughout the VA. We've got 230,000 people, 171 hospitals, 52 regional offices? Huge, huge group. Mm-hmm. One of the things, I think the point of 508 is to try to change the way technology is being manufactured. Just a quick story before I get to the next question. I had a lady who called me last week about 508, and she said, I have a distance learning program, much of which is graphical, and I've tried it with JAWS, and I've tried it with Window Eyes, and it doesn't work. So can you recommend to me a screen reader that it would work with? And I indicated to her over the phone, I didn't get a chance to talk with her, that the attempt here is not for us to modify our screen readers, but it's for her to change her product. And there are a lot of products out there that are being developed. I can think of a couple of mainstream products that would render our PCs into flower pots.
Are there any more questions?
Yes, Julie. This is John Abla from Bartimaeus Group.
Hi.
And I just wanted to have a couple comments. Maybe you can respond to them. I noticed in the Section 508 regulations that they say any information technology that's procured, used, or maintained after the 21st has to be accessible. But yet the procurement mechanism or the enforcement is only for products that are procured. So essentially, all the products have to be accessible, but there's nothing we can do about it if they're not, is what I get out of it. And the second thing is that I've seen a lot of people basically saying, okay, we can create customizations to screen readers, such as JAWS scripting, to solve some of these problems and make an application accessible. And it's kind of my view that the application needs to meet the Section 508 guidelines, and even if it is accessible with JAWS scripting, it's not necessarily 508 compliant for people who aren't using that technology. Do you consider that to be kind of a Band-Aid solution that should be a temporary fix for agencies until they get compliant software?
This whole issue of to what extent is it the assistive technology that's supposed to solve the problem and to what extent is the information technology supposed to solve the problem is very muddy and will probably just get muddier. Really, Section 508 doesn't apply to the assistive technology industry. There's nothing they have to do. It's the mainstream information technology vendors that are primarily affected, because if they want to sell to the federal government, they've got to meet these standards. It's an interesting point, though, because the standards don't really get you plug it in and it works, it's accessible, period. I don't know if we'll ever have that. One example of that are documents in PDF. We're still seeing lots of PDF, and you've got Adobe Point 5 out there telling everybody they're the solution and they make PDF accessible. Well, it hasn't worked for a lot of people. It didn't work for me. But what the standard says is you can require someone to go on to your website, download a different type of software, like a plug-in, like Adobe, and you can do that if that's your solution to making something accessible, as long as it's on your website and it's free. But what they don't really stress is also it has to work. And if, you know, just because it's there and just because the manufacturer says this solves the problem, if it doesn't, it is the federal government's responsibility to make that information available in an alternate format. And if we keep insisting that they do that, pretty soon they'll get tired of doing that, and maybe they'll stop putting things up just in PDF. Time for one more question. Oh, I didn't answer his other question. What was your other question? Oh, that's an interesting one. I got to answer that. Up top on the statute, it says, thou shalt, federal government, procure, maintain, use, and develop electronic and information technology that complies with the standards, period. Way down below, in Section F, it says, the procurement provisions apply to procurements as of June 21st. The government has interpreted that provision to mean that the enforcement provisions don't apply to use, maintain, and develop after June 21st. Now, I tried to make the argument that, no, that's not what they're trying to do in Section F. What they're trying to do is tell you what date the thing becomes effective. Why would they put use, maintain, and develop up at the very top in the charging statement of the statute if they didn't mean for you to have to comply with it? But they all went back and they huddled and they came back to me and said, this is our position and that's that. So that's the position of all the federal agencies, that procurement only is covered. What that means in practical terms, let's say employees within the federal government develop a website. That's not a procurement. What if they maintain, use, alter? You know, you're always adding to websites. When does it kick in that they have to be accessible? Those questions are not yet answered. One more question, Mitch says. Well, I thank you. I do have handouts in Braille and on disk, so please take them so I don't have to take them home. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I need your first one.
That's okay. We're dancing up.
We're doing more than dancing. I almost tripped. Before we wrap up, or before we send you on your way, actually, I want to thank everyone for participating and attending today. I don't know. Skip, are you still here? Oh, good. Just in case these two programs helped you decide you want to join ACBGE, I'll make Skip's life a little more difficult. If there's anyone here who would like to join this organization, the dues are $10 per year. We have a great mixer. We have a great program. We try to put a great program together every year. And we have a newsletter from time to time. So anyone wants to join, you can be any kind of a government employee, and even if you're not, you can join us. We'll let you. But local, county, state, federal, college employee, raise your hand if you wish to join, and Skip will find you. Otherwise, it's been a great program today, I think. I want to thank Jonathan for his work getting us on ACB Radio. I will now expect to be getting emails from weird places in the world finding out about all the stuff we talked about. When I get an email from Uganda, I'll know why.
Those other places in the world think that America's weird, though.
Yes.
It's relative.
Uganda.
It's relative.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Jonathan?
It's relative.
Ah.
What's weird to you is not weird to them, you see.
Well, I know.
Yes.
I know.
Okay, now.
So I thank Jonathan and all of the folks who participated today, and hopefully we will see you in Houston. That concludes the program for today. So long.
Cares, and to all of you listening in weird places around the world, I hope you enjoyed that coverage of the special interest affiliate ACBGE, the American Council of the Blind Governmental Employees. And we will be back at 8 tomorrow morning. It's election day tomorrow at ACB, and you'll hear it all live on ACB Radio Mainstream. Till then, good afternoon from Des Moines, Iowa.